we are going to see what are the gauge symmetry of the first order action for gravity. And but first, I want to finish what I started yesterday. So this is a quite general framework in the Lagrangian formalism. And so I won't spend too much time because, in fact, so we will see that we are going to go directly then in the canonical framework. Okay. So here is just more, this general framework is more just to give you an idea that, in fact, what you know already from global symmetry, so it's what we reviewed yesterday. Okay, so when you have a global symmetry, this means that you can write the transformation of your field under this shape, where you have epsilon here, which is a constant. Then we have seen that we can define the conserved current and the conserved charge, so we can recover Nutter's first theorem that you should know from Hamiltonian mechanics. So here you have the usual theorem, which tells you that as soon as you have a symmetry, you have a conserved charge associated to it. And but so this equation, which is the generalized Bianchi identity, is valid for any kind of symmetry. So yeah, just to finish on this global symmetry, yesterday at the end of the lecture, Alessandro did the remarks that, so I gave you an example how to how to get the charge and in the computation to show that the charge was really conserved. I use the fact that at some point you want that the divergence of the current to vanish, and indeed he was right to make the point that the assumption I did about the 2D the issue was that it was not a 2D surface because I did the calculation for any dimension, and I did that my so spatial surface hypersurface was compact, and of course this is not it's not going to work in every case. So, but the aim of this example was not to give you a general solution, because of course you have to look at specifically every time, especially if you're not working in three dimension. So, but it was a good point to mention that indeed if you have a compact surface, that doesn't mean that you have no boundary. Okay, so this was good to mention. But so I'm not going to come back on that here. It was just really the aim of this was just to show you that from this general equation, you can recover what you're supposed to know from a global symmetry. And now I'm also not going to spend too much time on the other point, which is when we look at a local symmetry. And so in this case, the interested cases are covered by the variation of this form. So here I'm going to say that we're going to look at a gauge symmetry. So, and we're going to look at variation of this form, where now E is a field. Okay, so it's depend on the space-time point. And you can also add the first derivative. And so the idea is that if you rewrite this equation, so in this case, usually we can choose epsilon in such a way that it's small enough. It vanishes outside a compact surface. So we can consider that we don't need to consider this term. Okay. And so here, if we go back to this equation, we get a kind of generalization for a current. Okay, so we get such an equation that I'm not going to develop much more. I'm just going to give you some references if you want to. So, and then, yeah. So I'm just considering, and of course, on shell. Okay, so on shell, this term is zero. And in the case of a local symmetry, usually in most of cases, you can choose epsilon in such a way that you don't need to take care about this term. And so you see that this can be a kind of generalization of a current. But so the main point here is that now, since you are dealing with a field here, this means that you have, in fact, infinitely many charges. Okay? So this kind of analysis is still valid, but now you can see that as infinitely many charges, okay, which are conserved. And I'm not going to derive this, but we will see that, in fact, these charges will appear in the canonical analysis as constraint. Okay? So here, this will give the charges are going to give the constraint in the when we are going to do the Hamilton canonical analysis of our framework. And so if you're interested with more detail for this analysis, you can have a look to Bianca's note. Yeah, 1 second. And otherwise, you can have a look to this paper. So it's called Hamilton's formalism, but the first part is on the Lagrangian analysis of the stuff. So formalism, and it's you can find it on archive. So it's for system with constraints, so exactly what we are interested in. And it's from Andreas Wipf, and it's already from 1893. So it's PH83. Yeah, so Florian, you had a question?
Yeah, are these variations P and C allowed to depend on the value of the field phi?
Yeah. So B and C here depend on your field, yeah, variable. On the space, so yeah, on the space time, so on the space time point and on the field. And the first, you can even have some first derivative of your field appearing here. Okay, so really here, just the idea is that, so in gravity, we are going to be interested in this kind of symmetry. So gauge symmetry are local symmetries. And we will see that these symmetries are going to be seen as constrained in the canonical analysis. So now I just want to give you what are the gauge symmetry of the first order action. Okay, so you should already have an idea from what we said. So what are going to be the gauge symmetry of our action? Very good. And quite surprisingly, we are going to see that, in fact, there is an additional gauge symmetry in 3D. But indeed, we already did the counting of degrees of freedom. So you know that only with rotation and diffeomorphism, you get the right number of degrees of freedom. So in fact, this other symmetry is not going to be independent from the other. But it's what is going to make 3D gravity also so simple is that, in fact, you can rewrite the diffeomorphism symmetry as a combination of rotation symmetry and translation symmetry. Okay, so we'll see that in detail. So it's going to simplify things a lot, of course. Okay, but let's first look at the symmetry. So now it's 3B gauge symmetry of the first order action. For gravity. So indeed, we're going to start with the two kinds which are obvious. Yeah?
Is there a partial mu by any chance outside in the last equation on the board at the top?
Is it what?
Is there a partial derivative outside acting on this, or is it just this?
Yeah. So it's coming from this, sorry, yeah, maybe I missed. Yeah, so in fact here, more or less, thanks for noting. Yeah, what I wanted to say is that the generalization of the current, so the conservation of the current is given by this now equation. And in fact, since this equation is valid for any field here, you can you can forget about the integral, and so this gives you the conservation for the equation for the what we call so the generalized current here. Okay, thanks. Okay, so let's go back to our action. So I'm going to give you, so here I'm not going to check that indeed this action is really invariant under the transformation I'm going to give you, but you can check that because I'm going to, so you can check it by yourself because I'm going to give you what are the transformation on the basic variables, okay? So then you just have to check that indeed your action is invariant. So, and we have this density, weighted density. Okay, so this is our action. And so as we said, we have two kinds of gauge symmetry, which are already obvious, which is the rotation and in the internal indices. So I'm going to start with that. So the first point are going to be internal rotation. And so here, I'm going to show what is the transformation of the basic variable under an infinitesimal rotation and infinitesimal diffeomorphism. Because what I want to see then is once in the canonical analysis, we are going to obtain constraint, and then I want to show that this constraint indeed generate this symmetry. So for this, we need to have the explicit expression of the action of this symmetry on our variables, okay? So that's why we're going to spend a bit of time. So let's look at the cotriad. Since our action is written in terms of the cotriad. So cotriad under an internal rotation is going to transform as a prime k mu okay, so now I want to look at the infinitesimal level. Level, so I'm infinitesimal rotation that I'm going to write in this form. So let me know if this is clear to you. So if I'm writing this infinitesimal rotation, can you, as a global rotation, do you know what is its rotation with respect to with which angle and around which axis? Is it obvious if I'm writing under this form? Or my question is, do you know if I'm writing my rotation R as exponential of so an angle times the axis, and then scalar here is the generator of SO3, okay, from this form. Is it obvious to you how I get to this form and what I'm supposed to write here or not? If it's not, I can just.
Theta n cross j.
Yeah, so no, in fact, this epsilon comes from the fact that at some point you have a vectorial product, but it's come from if you act with the x, then you see that this is going to be, the axis is just in fact given by the vector lambda here, okay? So it's here, it's even with, if you have a plus here, it's minus. So it's come from this rotation, epsilon, and here you have the vector lambda, and so the angle is just the norm of your vector. So the angle here is minus this, and you get, this gives you the axis. So is it obvious when you, how you go from here to here? So to come from here to here, in fact, you just, if you want to do it, you just use the spin one representation of your, so you write this at the first order, of course, and so you develop your exponential, and then you write that epsilon g okay, and you use the spin one representation of your generator, which are given as 3x3 matrices, and so you get lambda 1, G1, where G1 can be, so I can give you the expression here, 0, 0, minus 1, plus, etc., lambda 2, where G2 is the second generator, so you get 1, and plus, so the last term, J3, lambda 3, J3, and which is okay, so this is just, are just the generator of FO3 in the spin one representation, and if you write explicitly this matrix, you can write it. You get this expression, okay? Okay, so this is just the infinitesimal action. So now we want to look at the variation of the co-triad, okay? So variation of the co-triad, so I'm going to denote it like this, so it's under the rotation, and here the parameter of the rotation is the lambda, so, and so you get at the first order, so it's just given also by, the, if you differentiate this with respect to epsilon, prime, and you get that it's just epsilon k chi I k mu lambda I. Okay, so now let's have a look to, so this is just a covector, and now let's just have a look the change of the connection. So this was for the co-triad, and now we can find the change of the connection using, so this expression. Using that you have that by definition is equal to be right with the indices. And so if the co-triad transform under the rotation, then this means that the triad is going to be transformed with the inverse matrix, which is just of the rotation, which is just the transpose, okay? And then you can get, so I let you look at this, you obtain that mu prime LK plus, so GM d mu, the inverse MK. So let's check indices, mu M L, okay. Now I have a K.
Where is it?
Yeah. One K is missing. Thanks. Okay, so now at the infinitesimal level, what do we get? So once again, I'm using just this expression for form, so it's in first order in epsilon and of the rotation. And so, and I'm also going to replace mu jk by replacing epsilon in order to have only one form, L mu, okay? And so I get that the infinitesimal variation of our spin connection is equal to the derivative m l I l mu, and then mu I, which is exactly the covariant derivative of your vector of rotation, your axis of rotation. Okay, so these are the fundamental equation we want for the rotation. And now, so let's now have a look to the diffeomorphism. Okay, so the idea of diffeomorphism is that they are going to move point around on the manifold. Okay, so let's and so usually we are going to consider a one parameter family of diffeo, where you have that phi of zero is identity, okay? And then the map is going to move further away for bigger value of epsilon. So in fact, if you prefer, if you look at this for p, which is fixed, okay? Then this is going to generate a flow lines, when epsilon is going to grow. And so it's a, so here if you consider p fixed, but you vary epsilon, okay, what you get is a flow lines generated by a vector field. V, and by definition, you have that the pullback of for any function. If you look at the flow of any function, this gives you, and this is also what we call the Lie derivative, okay, of a scalar function. And in fact, by definition, the transformation generated by diffeo are going to be written under the Lie derivative. So have you seen the Lie derivative? Or? Okay, perfect. And so in our case, so here it's just a scalar function, but so in our case we're interested in just one form, okay? So it's kind of, it's covector. So in fact we're interested in the transformation of a covector, and so for this you need to know what is the pullback of a covector, okay, to get the expression. So I'm not going to give you too many details, but so the transformation of a covector under a diffeomorphism, okay, family. So here the infinitesimal form of the diffeo is going to be written like x mu plus epsilon v mu, okay. And so if we look at a covector alpha in term of coordinate, okay, so the transformation by the diffeo of any covector is given by definition by the Lie derivative, and so this is by definition the derivative with respect to epsilon of the pullback of your covector here. And in terms of coordinate, you can write this as Okay, so this is in terms of coordinates. And so what does it mean? Intuitively, you know that DFAO is a change of coordinates, okay? And so here you see that, in fact, this is just so the Jacobian, okay, of a change of coordinate with the map phi, which is the DFAO here. Okay, so here what you see here is just, in fact, the new coordinate of your pull back one form, okay? So this is just the Jacobian to make simple, And so if now you go at the infinitesimal form, or you apply the derivative here, you get that it's in terms of V and plus V alpha. Okay, and doing the same thing, so here I'm looking at a co-vector, okay, but if I were looking at a vector, then the transformation by a DFAO will be also the Lie derivative on this vector, so then you do the same thing, but here in terms of coordinate, you will get the inverse Jacobian. No, you will also get, yeah, but you go in the other way. And then here when you developed, you expand that in terms of at the infinitesimal level, you recover the Lie bracket between V and your vector of interest, okay? So you can, but here we are just dealing with covectors, that's why I'm just giving this expression. And so now explicitly for our variable, you get that the infinitesimal variation of fields under DFAO is so given by the Lie derivative, and so what is the, yeah, let's put D for DFAO here, so by definition it's the Lie derivative, and here, so yeah, just a point that the DFAO is not going to take, they don't take into account the internal indices, okay, they just act on the space-time indices, so that's why you just need to consider covector for one form for the space-time indices. And so here you get the same expression exactly. Mu plus the same thing for the spin connection. Okay, so I'm not going to write it explicitly in terms of components. It's exactly the same. You just replace your E by your spin connection. But so here, what is interesting in 3D and make things also so simple is that, in fact, we are not going to deal so much with the DFAO because we have an additional symmetry, which are the translation. A translation symmetry, and from the counting of degrees of freedom, we know that this symmetry cannot be independent from the two others. And indeed, I'm going to show you that you can rewrite the DFAO as a combination of the translation and the rotation here in 3D. Okay? So let's. So this is a bit surprising to have this additional symmetry, and they are going to shift only. Yeah, the triad. So they shift only the triad or co-triad variable. And of course, I let you check that indeed your action is invariant under this symmetry. I'm not going to do it here. But so this is going to be characterized by a parameter, let's say n, g, and so the variation by translation of my form is just given by the covariant derivative of this parameter. And MK. MK. And D mu. It's the N here. for the parameter, so n t of omega is equal to 0. And so, of course, check that. So this is an exercise for you. Check that the action is invariant by replacing just E by this delta E, OK? OK, but then let's show now that explicitly that these symmetries are not invariant. We already know that from the counting degrees of freedom. So let's check it explicitly. So they are not going to be independent on shell. So let's look at the relation among symmetry generator. And we can see that, we can check that if you look at the transformation of your co-triad with respect to the rotation, plus the translation, where here the parameters are given by you can write this as so let me explain you what I mean, minus T G mu nu, where here this is going to be 0 when the equation of motion are satisfied. And so where here I denote the omega as omega E mu. Why is it omega? No, it's a V. V mu. And this is so our parameter for the rotation. And you can check that is just and so this defines the parameter for the translation. And you can check that you have also the same relation for the transformation on the spin connection. B mu plus sigma, then you get that on omega, you get that this is equivalent to the DFO transformation with parameter sigma here on omega minus F J mu nu, where also this is also equal to 0 on shell. Okay, so from this you can see that 3D indeed is very simple because DFO symmetries here can be DFO symmetries can be replaced by a translation symmetry. And so this is really characteristic from, of course, 3D gravity. OK, so These are the symmetries we have in our action. And so now the next part is going to be about the canonical analysis of the, yeah.
And so I just wanted to confirm that this identity which you have written, it is only true in three dimensions.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have this additional symmetry in 4D, and yeah, you cannot write your Diffeo symmetry as a translation, well, plus a rotation, but you can. Yeah. This is 3D. Yeah.
What do you call the translations?
Okay, so where is my translation? yeah, so it's just going to, but it's a way it acts on a co-triad on your triad. Okay, so this is, and there is no the action on the spin connection here is zero. So this is, yeah, is characteristic of you just shift your triad field. Okay.
So you take the triad at point P and you shift it to P plus N, something like that.
Yeah, and then you get this. Yeah, you get this transformation.
What's this TJ you do?
Sorry?
The T on the right hand side.
Here?
Yeah.
So here so here you have the flatness and here is the torsion equation. And so it's also equal to zero on shell. Okay, so here it's the torsion of the spin connection. And so it's also zero on shell. So this means that on shell, your DFAO can really be replaced by just a translation, and you already have your rotation symmetries. Okay, so now what we're going to do is to look at the first order action, do the canonical analysis of this action, and we will see that we will have constraints. And we are going to show that indeed these constraints are going to generate these symmetries. So we are going to get a flatness constraint, which is going to generate the translation symmetry, and we're going to get the Gauss constraint, which is going to a Gauss constraint, which is just the rotation symmetry. Okay. So let's go to the. So if there is no other question on that, let's go to the. So the fourth part of the lecture and. Yeah, and so we will see that in the canonical formulation, for example, observables that are better defined in the canonical formulation, it's also easier to make account of the number of degrees of freedom, and it's going also to be the starting point for the Dirac quantization, so the loop quantum quantization. Okay, so we really need to go by this step. Okay, so let's start with a short review, just to fix also notation, to be sure that everyone is familiar with that. So we started with, so now we are in the canonical analysis. So we started with our action as a function of Q, okay? Defined with our Lagrangian. And so you know that then you need to perform a Legendre transformation to get the formulation, so the Hamiltonian formulation. So here, then we're going to denote P, define P as d rho L or dq dot, and then we get that. Now, this is our momentum, and we can rewrite this section as P Q dot minus what we call the Hamilton of our theory, which is a function so here it's made Legendre transformation, so I guess this is not new for you, and this defined here a symplectic structure, okay, associated. And the set of variable Q and P are going to be our, yeah.
Should the pH of P and Q?
Oh, yeah. Thanks. Yeah, very good. OK, and so we have a symplectic structure given by the canonical bracket, given by Q. P is equal to 1 here. And so then you know that for general function on your phase space variable, then you just get that f with g is defined as d rond f d rond p q g. And so here I wrote everything for a single variable, but if you have several variables, then you just add indices and you have a sum. And so here we can also understand p as an independent variable. Okay, so this means that we want to consider the action as a function of q and p, and then we get the first order action. Well, so the same. And so from this action, again, you can find the momenta conjugated to P and Q. And you just get that. So if they are both considered as independent variable, and so you get the momenta, which are defined as d rond s d rond q dot. And you get P, of course. And here you get minus Q, where you need to do an integration by part. And so you recover the Poisson bracket, since you get, yeah, so here you get minus 1. So in fact, it's just to say that you can always rewrite a second order action as a first order action by considering so variable independent here. Okay, and so the time evolution, as you know, is just given by the flow. You know that the Hamiltonian is going to define a flow, and it's going to give you the time evolution of your system. So what is so the time evolution is given by the flow generated by the Hamiltonian. So you just get that Q dot is given by the flow generated by the Hamiltonian, and if you write explicitly in terms of coordinates, P with H, and again you get a minus. But this can be also defined for any function, phase space function. So for any F, you get that and you can even write your function using the Taylor expansion in terms of the flow of your Hamiltonian. So using a Taylor expansion, you can just write that you get here. So it's the flow of a phase space function generated by the Hamiltonian. But we can talk about flow of F under any phase space, any phase space function is going to generate a flow, and in particular in our case, we're going to be interested in the flow generated by the constraint here. Yeah, Florian.
Could you repeat why pi p is not zero?
Okay, so here you consider that p is an independent variable, and so you need to look at the the conjugate momenta, so it's defined by this. And here, in fact, you just on this equation, you just perform integration by part. Okay.
Why don't we not take the variational derivative rather than just the partial derivative of this extended Lagrangian?
Yeah. So what is your question? Why do?
Well, to get p from q, we just took the partial derivative of the Lagrangian by q dot. But
yeah. So
now
here
we seem to be taking a variational derivative.
So it's a, yeah, it's the same here. You can rewrite this as yeah.
The thing is, if you don't take the variational derivative, then you won't get pi p to be not zero, because you cannot integrate the Lagrangian itself as a function by parts.
Yeah.
Take variational derivative.
I'm just confused because there's no explicit p dot dependence in the extended Lagrangian, but I think
about yeah. So you will see that we are going to do the same thing in the gravity case. So hopefully it's going to I'm going to come back on that. Okay. So maybe it's going to become clear at this point. Okay. So okay. So here you have the flow of F. Generated by the Hamiltonian, and we see that any we can look at the flow generated by any phase space function by H, and in particular in our case we're going to be interested by the flow generated by the constraint we're going to get. Okay, so yeah, let's go to the case of gravity now. Going to go here, maybe. And the starting point, of course, is our first order action. And we are going to perform the canonical analysis. So we need to make a 2+1 splitting of space-time first. So we are going to consider that our spacetime can be written as sigma time r. So now let's go to gravity. And so for the equal, yeah, we need to write, make the splitting of spacetime. And we are going to choose adapted coordinate, okay? So mu now, our space-time coordinate is going to be at 0a, where r are going to be the special part, okay, of our coordinate. And so we are going to consider that we can look at space-time, sorry, where here sigma is considered as equal time surface, hypersurface. And so we want to rewrite. So our starting point is our mu. And so we are going to split everything in terms of, yeah, so time coordinate and space coordinate. Okay? So here, what we are interested in is to isolate the time derivative to define the momenta. Okay? So where do you see where, from which component here we are going to get a, so here, of course, you don't have any time derivative, but from which component you are going to get time derivative here? So maybe I can give you again what was f mu nu of L. So you already, you add the time derivative, the not derivative of your connection. So here, yeah, I'm going to switch from omega to A just because, so in the canonical analysis of this action, in the all the literature you will find this this notation. So yeah, sorry, it's, maybe it's going to be a bit confusing, but so just to and mu, and then you add the term with epsilon L jk. Mu, mu. Okay, so here A is my connection, my spin connection. Okay, so we want to isolate the term with the time derivative. So from which term is it going to appear here? So f mu nu is antisymmetric, okay? So I don't have any f 0, 0, of course. But so I'm going to have f 0, A, and then some F A B. Okay, so you see that from this one, of course, you won't get any time derivative. So the only time derivative are going to come from this this term. So this means that in the action, we're going to keep this one and just isolate the time derivative from here. And so I'm going to use as a notation. Yeah, I'm going to said that epsilon 0 AB is going to be this coefficient. Okay, so let's rewrite this action.
Sorry, one question. So letters for indices from the beginning of the alphabet, like A and B, they are just go from 1 to 2. And
yeah.
But the frame indices, or so the internal indices, there are still Latin indices, but they start like later in the alphabet, like J, K, L.
Yeah, okay. And go from 1 to 3. Okay, so here we don't do any gauge fixing, which is different from what happened in 4D. Okay, so in 4D you also have, when you introduce the tetrad, you also have a gauge group, but then you perform a gauge fixing, and so it's going to reduce also to 3 indices. But here we keep the gauge group SU2. Okay, so we still have 3 indices for the internal indices. And it starts from AJK, and the AB will be the spatial indices. Yeah, so it's going to be maybe a bit confusing. So let's just write, I'm going to give you what is the action. So it's, is it obvious to you that the time derivative is going to appear here? So here you can rewrite this action as epsilon J B. Yeah, so maybe, yeah, just I'm going to forget about this minus sign. I'm going to add this one half also just to, so it's just question of convention from different sources, and in the canonical analysis you usually start from this one. So I'm going just to add this one half here, which is in fact you see is going to disappear for most terms, because since here it's antisymmetric in 0a, in fact you have twice the term with the, yeah, so you will see. Yeah. Okay, so we get, and you can check that indeed the one half disappear plus. Here we keep the one half because we haven't touched at the curvature tensor plus another term proportional to, which comes from the last term of this one, which is A, so BG plus epsilon KLM A LA E MB, and then I need to add, epsilon AB DT. Okay, so this is our action written with just splitting the space-time indices. And so you see that from here, from this term, we can deduce the conjugate, the momenta. So we get that here we are going to define the electric field, which is the Yang-Mills electric field. It's the same. So as ABJ is going to be AG, and so here we have A and a G, and it's given so by epsilon AB and so we get the canonical pair of variable in the canonical approach, which is given so by here. So now we are going to work with this variable. So we have one equal pair, so which is given by AAG and the special part of the connection, okay? So if we look at the Poisson bracket of these two variables, so B, K, Y, we get that they are conjugated. And we see that, so for the other variable in particular, here, the these two variables, okay, they don't have any time derivative. So in fact, they are just Lagrange multiplier. Okay? And so when we are going to look at the equation of motion, we're going to get only constraints, which are given by this term, which is just the flatness constraint. And from this term, we are going to get, in fact, it's the spatial part of the torsion here, which is going to be equal to zero. And this is what we're going to call the Gauss constraint. So we're going to get a flatness constraint from this curvature tensor and the Gauss constraint for the from the torsion. Okay, so let's just write that. These two are just Lagrange multiplier. Okay, there is no time derivative of this variable. So they are not considered as dynamical variable, but just as Lagrange multiplier. And so from the equation of motion, you just get here, we can conclude on that. And so, and all the other Poisson bracket vanishes, okay? You only have this non-trivial Poisson bracket. And so you have that zero are just Lagrange multiplier, and you get as equation of motion just constraint, okay? So you vary your your action with respect to these two Lagrange multipliers, and you get that as the equation of motion, you just get that Fj, which is defined as 1/2 of Fabj, is equal to 0. And this is a curvature constraint on phase space variable, which is going to be called the flatness constraint. And from the variation with respect to A, which is 0, we get that this term is equal to 0. And this is a special part of the torsion. Okay, and so we get, and we're going to call this constraint the Gauss constraint, and it's the same which appear in the Young-Mills theory. Okay, so here you get that 1/2 AB is also equal to 0, and this is what we call the Gauss constraint. Okay, so tomorrow we are going to analyze this constraint and have a look to the algebra of constraint. Okay? Yeah?
In this gravity case, is this Poisson bracket the same as this one where P and Q replace the E and A?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, except that now you are dealing with functional derivative. Okay? Because here it's, you are dealing with field variable, but it's really the generalization of here. And so tomorrow we will see that, in fact, indeed, you can rewrite really this as. So the same product as the PQ dot product minus what is here is going to be called the Hamiltonian. And in our case, we will see that the Hamiltonian is just a linear combination of the constraint, which is very characteristic from gravity here. Okay, so this means that the Hamiltonian is going, we are going to deal with a completely a constrained system. Yeah.
Variables are going to be A and the co-triad, so it seems kind of strange that you have this capital E now.
Yeah, but it's related to the, it's just that it's a densitized triad, okay? Yeah. And we get the same thing in, it's a densitized co-triad here, if you prefer, and we get exactly also the same thing in 4D. It's going to be a densitized triad. Okay, any other questions here? Okay, so tomorrow, we will go on with the constraint and the algebra of constraint. Okay, thanks.